The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events. Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. Our guest today, David, Richard Duncan, has written probably one of the clearest analysis of what has happened over the last few years to get us to the point that we're at, what's happening right now, and what he thinks we need to do with the money that TARP and all this other bailout money is going towards to actually solve the problem.
Yeah, Kevin, Richard Duncan has served with ABN AMRO in London, with the World Bank in Washington, with Salomon Brothers in Bangkok and James Capital Securities, and he's also now with Black Horse Asset Management. He's published two books, The Dollar Crisis, Causes, Consequences, and Cures, back in 2003, and the conversation today will center on the corruption of capitalism, his most recent effort, and published by CLSA.
Well, I know The Dollar Crisis had a pretty profound impact on your life back in 2003 when he was analyzing a problem that had not yet occurred in the minds of the people in the economy, but it was coming, and sure enough, the way he laid it out in that book actually was the way it played out.
Kevin, I have a lot of books on my shelf, and this is one that is not only one that I've referred back to on a number of occasions, but look at as kind of a mile marker. 2003 was the year that I left Morgan Stanley and came back to work with our family business. And this is one of those books that was sort of an eye-opener or a reawakening, if you will, some concepts and ideas that I'd long been familiar with, the kinds of things that as a family we would talk about over the dinner table, maybe right. Even breakfast and lunch. But it was a good reminder, and from an objective third party, I said, okay, these are realities, the realities of our day, and they have to be addressed, and professionally I'm willing to make changes in light of it.
Well, we've got Richard Duncan on the line right now from Bangkok, Thailand, so why don't we just go to that?
Richard, you wrote in 2003 a book that was published by Wiley & Sons by the title of The Dollar Crisis, Causes, Consequences, and Cures, and it laid out several of the monetary and fiscal issues which we're now living with as a chronic state of instability. It should already sit on the shelves of our listeners. I assume that they've read it, and it is sitting on the shelf of everyone here in our office. You published a book more recently by the title of The Corruption of Capitalism, and we want to discuss that with you today. You've done three things in this more recent project. One, you look at the present global economy, and you assess what footing it rests on. And secondly, you've looked at the past, in particular those structural and policy-related issues which have set the stage for the current economic malaise. And lastly, you look ahead to what might restore U.S. economic stability and preeminence. Would you like to start with the past or the present?
Yes, let's start with the past, because I think it's very important to understand what's gone wrong, to understand where we are now and what could be done to resolve this crisis. When I was born in 1960, policymakers in the United States believed very strongly that it was their duty to balance the U.S. government budget and to make sure that the country's money was sound, in other words, backed by gold. They believed in these things just as their fathers, grandfathers, and great-grandfathers before them had believed this. And they feared that if they didn't do these things, that something very, very bad would happen. And as it turned out, they were right. By the time I turned 12, in 1972, those core principles of economic orthodoxy, balanced government budgets, and sound money had been abandoned. Starting in the 1960s, really under President Johnson, the U.S. started running quite large budget deficits by the standard of the time. And those budget deficits overstimulated the U.S. economy and started pulling in more imports, causing a deterioration in the country's balance of payments and an outflow of dollars from the country. And at that time, other countries had the right to convert their dollars into U.S. gold reserves under the rules of the Bretton Woods system. And so by 1971, when Nixon broke the link between dollars and gold, there were so many dollars held outside the United States that he really didn't have any choice except to end this link between dollars and gold, because the U.S. just simply didn't have enough gold left in Fort Knox to allow the conversion of all the foreign-held dollars. And once the link between dollars and gold was severed, this really opened Pandora's box, if you will, to all kinds of evils that have subsequently flown out. The beginning with, over time, the U.S. trade deficit started becoming larger and larger. And as the deficit grew larger, this was a boon for the global economy for decades. The United States bought more and more from other countries. Of course, the global economy grew and expanded. But ultimately, these U.S. trade deficits destabilized the global economy by creating extraordinarily large global imbalances. And those global imbalances are now coming unwound in this new Great Depression that we're experiencing. And in 2008, all of the debt that the United States had incurred, primarily as a result of its trade deficit, that debt couldn't be repaid by the private sector. And at that point, the global economy went into crisis, international trade collapsed, and governments around the world had to step in with extraordinary and unorthodox policy to prevent a complete replay of the 1930s Great Depression.
Well, looking back is very helpful. We have, as you mentioned, a new Great Depression, not only the Depression of the 1930s, but perhaps a slightly different variation on that theme today. Of course, the National Bureau of Economic Research has declared the recession over, which I think we can find, if not hilarious, perhaps we should find some comfort in it. Maybe they're looking at something that we're not. As an economist, maybe you could comment on that. What are they looking at versus what are you looking at that you would categorize as not only in a recession, perhaps a depression?
It's important to understand that this new depression, as I call it, came about really for exactly the same reason as the Great Depression did. The Great Depression originated in 1914, in my opinion, when all of the European nations went off the classical gold standard in order to finance World War I. At the beginning of World War I, the European nations broke the link between their currencies and gold so that they could issue enormous amounts of government credit they needed to use to finance the war. All of the credit created during that period led to the Roaring Twenties. It was a worldwide credit boom during the 1920s. In 1930, however, that credit couldn't be repaid. And at that point, the international banking system collapsed and international trade collapsed. And exactly the same thing has happened this time. This new depression originated because in 1971, the Bretton Woods system, which was more or less a gold standard, broke down. Afterwards, the United States started issuing enormous amounts of dollar-denominated debt to finance its government budget deficits and its trade deficits. And all of the credit that the U.S. issued sparked off a worldwide economic boom that lasted for 2 to 3 decades. But in 2008, the private sector couldn't repay that credit, and the international banking system collapsed, and international trade collapsed. So it's come about in exactly the same way. However, this time the policy response has been completely different. In the Great Depression, the policymakers believed very strongly that the government had to keep the budget balanced, and they did try as far as possible to maintain a balanced government budget. There were no Keynesian stimulus programs at that point. But this time around, they have completely adopted Keynesian policy, not only in the United States, but in every major government around the world, realizing that if the government doesn't spend enough money to continue stimulating the global economy, now that the private sector is cut off from any additional credit and the private sector is incapable of spending, if the governments do not step in, then the global economy would collapse into a 1930-style depression with a very significant contraction in the GDP and a return to 20 or 25% unemployment. So the policy response has been completely different this time. So coming back to your original question, when you say that the recession has been declared over, what everyone needs to be aware of is that we have a government budget deficit in the United States of approximately 10% of GDP. So last year, the U.S. economy contracted by roughly 2%. But had it not been for this $1.4 trillion budget deficit, equivalent to 10% of GDP, the U.S. economy wouldn't have just contracted by 2%. It would have contracted by minus 2, plus minus 10, minus 12, plus a multiplier. It really would have been a complete replay of the Great Depression with more than 20% unemployment. So it's difficult to say the recession is over, when, in fact, reality is that the U.S. economy and the global economy is on government life support. And without the support provided by these massive government budget deficit around the world and unorthodox monetary policy, then the global economy would actually be in severe recession, if not depression.
You describe an interesting transition from that of capitalism to what you call debtism, and then ultimately to statism, the process in play from the 1960s to the present. And early on in your book, you suggest that the regime that we're a part of today, a fiat money or bubble-oriented regime, is on its present course moving us towards total collectivization of society. Are there command economies that we should look at as a proxy for performance? You mentioned that we're now on government life support. Obviously, it's not desirable, but what is the next step from here?
We are now in a very difficult position. Of course, in the United States, there is outrage that the economy is in a position where it requires so much government spending. The public doesn't understand why the government has to have such a large role in directing the economy now. But it's very important that they come to understand why the government is playing this role. At this point, U.S. government spending is equivalent to 25% of the entire U.S. economy. In other words, out of every $100 spent in the economy, the government spending $25. Every country's GDP, every country's gross domestic product, is comprised essentially of four things. First is, in the U.S., personal consumption is about 70% of GDP. Next, business investment is about 16% of GDP. And then there is net trade, exports minus imports. In the United States, net trade is a negative number because the imports are always so much larger than the exports. So in the United States, net trade actually deducts 5% from GDP. And the remainder, roughly 20% of GDP, is government spending. So if we were to reduce government spending, as many Americans would like to see, as instinctively seems like the right course to take, if we were to do that, there's no reason to believe that that would result in higher personal consumption or higher business spending. In fact, just the opposite. If the government were to spend less, there would be fewer transfer payments, so personal consumption would contract, and with less government spending and personal consumption expenditure, private investment would also contract. So we find ourselves in a situation where we truly are reliant on U.S. government spending to prevent us from collapsing into a Great Depression. And it's a tragic situation for the United States to find itself in. It has come about as a result of a very long series of policy mistakes beginning in the 1960s, beginning with this abandonment of these core principles of economic orthodoxy that I referred to earlier, the abandonment of balanced government budgets and sound money. But nevertheless, here we are, and our options are increasingly limited. In fact, I think there are three ways forward for us. One, the government could immediately balance its budget, in which case, without any question, the United States and the world would collapse into a new Great Depression. The second option is we can carry on with trillion-dollar budget deficits, as we're now doing, for the next 5 years and perhaps the next 5 to 10 years. But ultimately, if we spend the money that in the manner in which we're currently spending it, this will just ultimately lead to bankruptcy over the long run and depression a little later instead of depression now. Okay, so that option is a little bit better than the first option of immediate depression, but it's not very attractive either. The third option is we could spend the government deficit spending on investments in new technologies in order to restructure the U.S. economy, to restore the economic viability of the United States economy. Because the sad fact is, because of globalization, the U.S. economy is simply no longer viable as it's currently structured. The United States economy has been de-industrializing for decades. Wage rates in the United States manufacturing sector are still roughly $200 a day. Wage rates in China and other developing countries in the manufacturing sector are $5 a day. There's no possibility that the United States can compete in most industries due to this enormous wage rate differential. Therefore, we have to face the fact that the U.S. economy is no longer viable. It's been supported for the last 15 years through economic bubbles. First the stock market bubble, and then the property bubble. But now both those bubbles have popped. During that period, wages in the U.S. haven't gone up. And as time goes by, the existing manufacturing jobs that still do exist in the United States are going to be destroyed. So the third option that I referred to is the U.S. government, instead of repeating Japan's mistake over the last 20 years of incurring very large budget deficits but wasting the money building bridges to nowhere, the United States government should learn from Japan's experience and not waste the deficit spending that it's very likely to undertake over the next 10 years. Don't waste it, but to invest it in new, very high-tech industries to restructure the U.S. economy, to restore its economic viability, so that the United States actually can produce goods that other countries want to buy, so that the United States can develop new industries that the government could tax and generate a tax revenue that would not only balance the budget, but ultimately help pay down the national debt.
Once again, you're listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary at McIlvaney.com. McIlvaney.com.
So there's two courses that we could go on from, you know, a fiscal and monetary standpoint. Japan might be one example where we've seen a continual increase in debt to GDP from 60 to 70%, now north of 200% of GDP. And it is somewhat sustainable, although they haven't recovered from a significant correction in 1990, it's not as if they have lived in some sort of an abyss either. The other option might be Zimbabwe, where you don't tap the debt markets, but instead the currency markets pay the price. And there you have inflation, superinflation, and hyperinflation. Coming back around to the debt issue, because it seems that that's what you're suggesting is the direction we have to go, not necessarily should go in a perfect world, but we no longer live in a perfect world. In fact, we departed from that in the 1960s. If that's the case, then the question I would have is, how sustainable is an increase in debt relative to our revenues, not just relative to GDP, but isn't it like the consumer being unable to pay his or her mortgage the full interest and principal amount and somehow renegotiating the unpayable portion and just adding it to and compounding it with the remaining principal? Is that ultimately sustainable from a revenue standpoint?
Well, yes, you raise a lot of important issues. That's why it is crucial how the U.S. government spends the money that it will have to spend in the future to keep us out of depression. If they waste it, fritter it away, building bridges to nowhere, or allowing special interest groups to steal it, then the outlook is very bleak. But if they invest it wisely in new technologies. Let me back up and let's talk about Japan for a second. I think there are three very important lessons that the United States government must learn from the Japanese experience. When a giant bubble pops, as it did in Japan in 1990, the first lesson is that, like it or not, it is inevitable that the government is going to have to spend enormous amounts of deficit spending to keep that economy from collapsing into depression. So as you pointed out earlier, Japan's government debt has increased from roughly 60% of Japan's GDP 20 years ago to 225% today. Right, they haven't solved their problem, but they have managed not to collapse into depression. So that is the first point. And you can see that the U.S. government and policymakers realize this. If you look at the budget projections provided by the U.S. Congressional Budget Office, they're more or less indicating that the United States will have almost $10 trillion worth of budget deficits over the next 10 years. So that's point number one. The government is going to have these deficits, like it or not. That's required to keep the economy out of depression. But point number two is much more encouraging, and that is it's going to be much easier to finance these budget deficits than people now anticipate. Look at Japan, 225% government debt to GDP, and the yield on their 10-year government bond is 1% or less. So that offers a great deal of hope as to what can be financed. But the third and the most important lesson is to learn from Japan is that the U.S. should not waste this deficit spending building bridges to nowhere, as they say was the case in Japan. Instead of having $10 trillion of budget deficits over the next 10 years and accomplishing nothing, if the government took a longer-term view and realized that it was going to have such deficit spending on such a large scale for so long, surely they could come up with a much more clever plan of how to spend that money, to invest that money in a way that it would not just disappear and become a burden for generations, but to invest it in a way that would produce new industries, new technologies, new jobs, new areas of expertise, new exports, and new government tax revenues. So, for instance, instead of spending $10 trillion over the next 10 years and just going deeper down the road to ruin, if the government were to spend an extra $3 trillion over 10 years, investing $1 trillion in solar energy, $1 trillion in genetic engineering and biotechnology, and another $1 trillion in nanotechnology, they could completely restructure the U.S. economy and give the United States an unassailable lead in 21st century technologies, essentially locking in another American century. A $1 trillion investment in solar energy over 10 years would give the United States eternal free energy, which, first of all, the United States government could tax, allowing it to recover the cost of investment. But more importantly, or equally importantly, that solar energy would cut the trade deficit by 40% because we would no longer have to rely on imported oil. And we wouldn't have to spend money militarily defending the sources of the foreign oil. So we could cut military expenditure as well. Or, again, a $1 trillion investment in genetic engineering would truly create miracles. It would quite possibly result in a genetic revolution on the same scale as the Industrial Revolution 200 years ago. That sort of investment would probably yield benefits such as a cure for cancer or a therapy that reverses aging. And as soon as a U.S. government laboratory starts selling a cancer vaccine, not only would the income from that balance that year's budget deficit, it wouldn't take long to pay off the entire national debt. So if we invested the money wisely, we could develop new products to sell, which would balance our trade deficit, and new industries, bringing in new tax revenues that would balance the budget and pay down the national debt. So if we invested the money wisely, we could restructure the economy and remain the dominant economic power well into the future.
So that is a look ahead at what we might do to restore U.S. economic stability and preeminence. You cover that in the last section of your book. Several things that I think that assumes is that our policymakers acknowledge that there are structural problems and do not look at sort of band-aid solutions for what are very serious issues. That's one thing. Coming back to Japan and the interest rates in Japan, they have been kept low for a very long time, largely because of the public's willingness to purchase government IOUs. And U.S. and global investors might have a different penchant, either for rates or for currency risk. And so that would raise a question for me, how can a low interest rate environment be perpetuated here in the U.S. when coupled with, for instance, the Federal Reserve's inflation targeting of 1% to 2%, and potentially even higher targets as the total stock of debt grows? You know, we're looking at a low to negative real rate of return environment. Is that good for fixed income?
Yes, there are very significant differences between the structure of the Japanese economy and the structure of the U.S. economy and the implications for interest rates in both countries. Japan, it is certainly fair to make the observation that Japan had certain advantages in financing this enormous increase in its government debt that the United States doesn't have. For instance, Japan has every year a large trade surplus, which brings money into Japan and becomes available to finance government debt. And also, Japan had a very high level of household savings. The household savings rate at the beginning of their crisis was practically 18%. And those are advantages the United States doesn't have. However, the United States does have one very important advantage that Japan, or for that matter, most other of our major competitors don't have. And our advantage is we have the dollar standard. Every year that the United States has a large trade deficit, and this year the trade deficit is going to be roughly $500 billion, every country's balance of payments must balance. So when the United States has a $500 billion trade deficit this year, that throws off $500 billion into the global economy, which is accumulated by central banks outside the United States. Those central banks print their own money and buy up the dollars entering their economy because they don't want their currencies to appreciate. And as the central banks accumulate this $500 billion, that is the equivalent of their trade surplus with our country, then they have $500 billion, which they must reinvest in a U.S. dollar-denominated asset of one kind or another if they want to earn any interest on those dollars. So in other words, our half a trillion dollar trade deficit this year will finance the first $500 billion of our government budget deficit. And this is an advantage that no other country has.
Is that assuming that our foreign trade partners are recycling those trade surplus dollars into government paper? And does that mean that, yes, we remain dependent on the international markets for soaking up the additional deficit spending and IOUs that we create as a result? I'm thinking in historic perspective, when Germany was cut off from the international markets following World War I, they were left with only one option, and that was issuing IOUs to their local communities. And it was at the point where the German public was choking on government IOUs and debt that they had to resort to quantitative easing or money printing, which of course brought about the 1923 and 24 hyperinflation. Is there no risk of soaking the sponge, so to say, filling to capacity the appetite for government debt, whether it's international or domestic?
Eventually, yes, of course there is. Eventually that appetite will completely be saturated, and when that day arrives, we will be facing a catastrophe from which there will probably be no exit, no happy exit possible. But that day is certainly not going to fall within the next 5 years, and probably not within the next 5 to 10 years. I truly believe we have a 5 to 10 year window of opportunity to come to grips with the severity of this, the nature of this crisis, to recognize that it is a structural crisis rather than a cyclical economic crisis. It's structural because the U.S. economy doesn't work the way it's currently structured. And we have a 5 to 10 year window of opportunity to recognize that and to take steps to restructure the U.S. economy so that it does work once again. And other countries have no real alternative except to buy U.S. government debt with their trade surpluses. Take a look at China. China's trade surplus with the United States is the factor that has completely transformed China from the China of Chairman Mao to the China where today Shanghai looks like the Emerald City in the Wizard of Oz. In 1990, China didn't have a trade surplus with the U.S. 2 years ago, their trade surplus with the U.S. was $250 billion. That $250 billion trade surplus is resulting in tens of millions of Chinese factory jobs. It is bringing in currents into China that is going into the Chinese banking sector as $250 billion worth of deposits, which fuels $250 billion of loan growth, which fuels 10% GDP growth and keeps their public employed. They are accumulating dollars, and once they have the dollars, they must reinvest those dollars in U.S. assets, U.S. dollar assets, if they want to earn any interest on them. Okay, you may be thinking, well, they don't really have to. They could buy some euros with those dollars, convert the dollars into euros. Well, okay, they could buy some euros. Of course, that would upset the Europeans because it would make the euro go to 2-1 against the dollar. But the more important point is, whoever they bought the euros from, those people would then have dollars. And those people would then have to buy U.S. dollar-denominated assets. Dollars are like farmland. The farmer can sell his farmland, and that doesn't make the farmland disappear. Someone else owns it. The same with dollars. If Chinese were to sell their dollars, whoever they sold the dollars to, they would then have to invest their dollars in U.S. dollar assets. So our trade deficit will boomerang back into the United States to finance our budget deficit. Every country's balance of payments must balance. So the larger our trade deficit becomes, the larger the capital inflows into the United States will be. And we should take advantage of that benefit created by the dollar standard and make use of that financing and spend the financing wisely to restructure our economy while we still have time.
So you're focusing on really prudential options, things that must be done now. With a 5 to 10 year window, the two questions are we appreciating the recycling of our trade deficit dollars into U.S. treasuries? And on top of that, what are we doing in terms of budget spending, budget deficit spending? Are we doing a good job in allocating those assets? Are we allocating them to the most opportunistic investment strategies for our country over the next 10, 20, and 30 years? And you've suggested technology, innovation in that area, significant investments, where the two things that we have to be cautious in is that the money that is spent is not wasted. that it must be spent is an inevitability at this point, in your opinion, and so the point is it cannot be wasted and it should not be stolen by special interest groups. If those two things can be avoided and the money goes to the right places, then the money that we spend, we may actually see a return on investment in terms of future tax revenues, which solves something that I was suggesting earlier, even more significant than debt to GDP, the debt to revenue numbers, which continue to be or even a greater issue for us in the future. Perhaps we can solve that as long as we create new sources of revenue and income.
Yes, precisely. The debate in the United States about the direction of U.S. economic policy has become dangerously unimaginative. On the one side are those people who believe that the government is and always will be the problem, and they advocate a reduction in government spending immediately. On the other side are those who hope that somehow the U.S. economy is going to right itself in the not-too-distant future and return to sustainable growth, and they advocate maintaining the budget deficits for a few more years and then reducing them. But both sides are wrong. If we cut the budget deficit now, the United States and the world collapses into immediate depression with untold geopolitical consequences. On the other hand, it's not correct to believe the U.S. is going to somehow right itself again in the absence of massive government budget deficits, because we're being deindustrialized by globalization. Our wage rates in the manufacturing sector are 40 times higher than wage rates in the developing world. Therefore, we're going to continue to deindustrialize. And it's only a matter of time. It's not going to take very many more years of 10% unemployment before the Americans come to the realization that globalization is really not working out very well for them. And they're going to vote for protectionism. There will be another Ross Perot who points out that globalization is not working. They will elect that man, and trade barriers will go up. That will be bad for America, terrible for the world, and catastrophic for countries like China that are so dependent on export-led growth. So our challenge is to find an alternative to that very unhappy scenario over the next 5 years. And the only viable alternative is for the United States to aggressively and boldly take advantage of the dollar standard, take advantage of this ability to finance trillions of dollars in debt, and to invest trillions of dollars on a scale that's simply too large to fail, too big to fail, in new 21st century technologies to give us an unassailable lead in 21st century technologies and to allow us to make new products that other countries desperately want to buy that they can't buy anywhere else at any price, like a cancer vaccine.
Well, there's a number of other topics that are worth looking at in even greater detail, and I would encourage our listeners to invest the time and certainly just a few dollars into your latest book, The Corruption of Capitalism. It is an excellent read. In fact, I decided to move that into the lineup of books that we read here in the office. We try to look at one book a month as sort of continuing education, and you do a masterful job at looking both at the past and the present and the future. And with an appreciation in this place, we do look at the past and say, without it, you really don't know what's coming, and you can't understand the present. So there's a similar model in terms of thinking in your book, as is reflected by our office here. And it'll be an excellent read and discussion that we have, and we'd invite all of our listeners to enter into that same conversation. So thank you very much for joining us today, Richard. And I look forward, next time I'm in Asia, to perhaps having our paths cross.
Yes, let's do that. And thank you very much for having me on the show. I appreciate it.
Look forward to having you on again.
Thank you.
Well, you've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick, along with David McIlvaney and our guest today, Richard Duncan. You can find us at McIlvaney.com, McIlvaney.com, or give us a call anytime at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.